You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
Our guest today is one of these people that if you try to introduce them and say everything that there is to say about them, by the time you're finished, it'll be time for the show to be over. This is a guy that had quite a career. If there's one word that's sent us around, it's the word blues, but he's been involved with it in many different ways. This is Chris Thomas King. He's born in Baton Rouge. He's the son of a blues musician, Tabby Thomas. His early songs were released under the name Chris Thomas. He has won awards, including Album of the Year, above Grammy and Country Music Awards. He's been in films, including Old Brother, Where Art Thou? And if you've never seen that, you should. It's one of the great quirky films of all time. He was also in Ray, the film about Ray Charles. And Chris, did you work with Ray Charles in that film?
I did the score with him, the score to the movie at his studio in Los Angeles. And I got a chance to work with him. Actually, I think he passed away just weeks before the film entered theaters. But yeah, that was a real highlight of my journey.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, what was he like?
well, he knows what he wants. He was in total control in the studio, even though the director, Taylor Hackford, was there trying to direct him. And in working with him, he took a liking to my plan, because even though Ray Charles is a person who has done all kinds of music, country, he can do anything, musically on the piano and especially with his voice. And so at a certain point, after I got over the awe of working with Ray Charles, it was just like working with Henry Gray, or one of the other blues musicians that I've worked with so many years, because, at his core, Ray Charles was just a brilliant blues musician and blues singer.
I've always said about Ray Charles that he wasn't born in New Orleans, but he should have been. Imagine if he'd have raised in New Orleans with all the musicians. If you could have hung around with Alan Toussaint a little while and Fats Domino and those kind of people, what a great experience that'd be.
He started his music career in New Orleans, which I write about Ray Charles in my book. And I write about the fact that he was in New Orleans staying at the Dewdrop Inn and playing at the Dewdrop Club when he was asked to do an arrangement for Guitar Slim on The Things I Used to Do, which became it's like a pretty standard 12-bar blues with kind of a gospel feel. And before that, Ray Charles, I wrote about in the book that he was doing, kind of a Nat King Cole or trying to find a pop sound with his music. But after those blues sessions in New Orleans, where he was living for a time, that kind of encouraged him to go full throttle with his with that gospel fervor that he had in his vocals. And a lot of the church people didn't like it, but hey, that's the blues.
Well, you've also won some country music awards, as he did. Those two albums he did of Born to Lose or I Can't Stop Loving You. I mean, they were just revolutionary songs.
Yeah, I mean, Ray Charles was brilliant.
Well, speaking of your book, from what I know about it, it sounds fascinating, and it raises a very important topic. The book was published in 2021, and it's called The Blues, The Authentic Narrative of My Music and Culture. And it makes a very interesting point in trying to, I'd say, the question of the origin of the blues has always been one that's confused me. You hear all kinds of things. It was in the Delta or in Memphis or in different places. But you look at that question and you come up with a pretty definitive answer. So to you, where did the blues originate?
It originated in South Louisiana, more precisely in New Orleans, in the 1890s. And that's when it originated. It's not a musical structure like people try to say that it is, like it's a 12-bar blues or you play it this way or that way. It's a music philosophy. It's a way, before you know you're getting ready to play the blues, before you even approach the piano and sit down at the piano. It's a, you know, you the music in front of you might be a pop song, you know, it could be something, a Broadway tune. But when you sit at the piano or sit down with your guitar, the way that you're going to express the music, that's where the blues comes in. The blues is more of it's a philosophy that came out of the Black Creole resistance of New Orleans to Black codes and Jim Crow, and during the Plessy versus Ferguson case that reached the Supreme Court. About separate but equal. It was during that time in the 1890s that this style of music came into the fore in New Orleans, and later it left New Orleans and went to Chicago when New Orleans closed Storyville, and eventually made its way to Harlem. But so when you hear songs like Jelly Roll Martin's Jelly Roll Blues, when you hear Mamie Desdunes, female singer who was the, you know, one of the first early composers that we know of, her song 219 Blues have been covered by everybody from Janis Joplin to whomever. But she was one of the earliest composers, and Jelly Roll Martin, as a young boy, heard her singing that tune, and he adopted it. And Lonnie Johnson, the great Lonnie Johnson, the guitarist, he helped kind of spearhead, he's the king of all the Delta blues guitars. So the music came out of New Orleans. It developed in New Orleans in the 1890s through the early 1900s. But then when it made its way onto phonograph records, that's when the blues took over the nation, so to speak.
So if you had to...
In the 1920s.
If you had to describe... I realize there's a lot of variations, but if you're trying to pigeonhole the blues, to try to describe it to somebody, what could you say it has a more melancholy sound to it?
No, it's antithetical to melancholy. That is the melancholy is a myth. That is not what the blues means. That's the Anglo definition of the word blue in the English language, which we all speak, you know. So if you look in the Oxford Dictionary, you'll see the term blues or feeling blue or sadness and all of this. But that's English. That's not African languages. That wasn't part of the Creole language. It's not French. So Louisianians didn't really speak Anglo-Saxon English until late in the, you know, for 100 or so years or so, you know, people spoke French or Creolized type of Haitian type of African mix of French called Creole. So the Creole meaning of blues, which is where the blues original definition is, and that is very important to know, it comes from the word soccer blue. It has more to do with morality, or like the word sacre bleu or sacre deal mean that you're cursing something sacred. So when you say you don't feel like we have things like blue laws that were when Louisiana was purchased by America, and the language of English began to be imposed upon Louisianians. And even the people in West Louisiana, the you know, whom we refer to as the Cajuns, they didn't really give up speaking French until the 1970s. So this English language is foreign to Louisiana, and it didn't really take shape and take hold in Louisiana until after until the 1900s. Even a lot of my information came from Black newspapers from New Orleans that have been digitized. And a lot of those Black newspapers were written in French. And you wouldn't print a newspaper in French unless you had a French-speaking audience to read it. So even the committee that was formed to fight Plessy versus Ferguson, it was a French-speaking Black committee that was formed. So that was the main language of the Black native New Orleans, at least the New Orleans families that had been here for, you know, since before Louisiana became a part of America. So basically what I'm trying to say is that the blues is blue entertainment. You had like Lenny Bruce, you would call him a blue comic. Red Fox, a blue comic. Richard Pryor, you would say that's a blue comic. Even today, like Dave Chappelle or Chris Rock, because of the way that they express their comedy, trying to get you to think or get your attention with profanities and all kind of other things, they are seen as blue comics. And then when you go and you try to buy alcohol or something, there's blue laws that say you can't buy alcohol on a Sunday, or you can't. And back in this, at this time in Louisiana, when the blues came about, they were trying to ban people from playing their music on Sunday. Like, we wouldn't have New Orleans Jazz Festival on a Sunday or any blues festival on a Sunday if it was up to the, you know, the Anglo people that came in with the Protestant, you know, clash with the Catholic culture of Louisiana. So I go deep into all those things in the book, you know, from the clash of Protestantism and Catholicism, the voodoo nature of the express, how Black people express themselves, you know, through the Catholic worship services. So I go through all of those things really deeply, but anybody who is not familiar with the blues or not familiar with jazz or not familiar with these musical terms, the book really is more of a sociology type of study, because it tells you that the blues, the word blues, as far as Louisiana is concerned, as far as Louis Armstrong was concerned, Jelly Roll Martin, all our original blues musicians, they called their music the Basin Street Blues, the West End Blues, the Jelly Roll Blues, the this and that blues, as a proud Creole type of defiance to the annexation of their way of life and their culture. They had a lot of freedom that was taken away from them with those Black codes and with the Plessy versus Ferguson segregation laws that was passed.
Okay, so it's like Basin Street Blues, which is sort of an upbeat sound. And I know you're dealing with something very complex about that, but I've always wondered, what makes that the blues?
Well, what makes it the blues is that, you know, it's a cultural, like I said, it's a cultural expression, and that's what makes it the blues. All right.
It wasn't the melody or the message or anything else. It was just the classification of the kind of music it was that made it the blues.
It's a cultural expression. Like in New Orleans, when they do a second line, which they've been doing for 200 years, what kind of music would you call that? You know, I mean, it doesn't really matter what song they're playing during the second line procession. It's the ritual. It's the custom. It's the way they express, you know, this idea that the blues is sad and melancholy. That doesn't fit in New Orleans culture, because even at funerals, you know, people drink and party and have a second line. You think they're dancing on the person's grave, but they're not. That's the way the unique Louisiana culture celebrates someone passing, is they basically have a party, you know, and music is a big part of that. So, it's not. If I ask the person, what chord progression do you use for rock and roll or pop music? You know, nobody talks about a style. I mean, what chords or notes do you use to make classical music? There's no other musical genre that is talked about in such a way. You can use any note on the piano or any note on the guitar to express the blues. The main thing that is happening here with the blues and with it's a cultural tug of war. We still dealing with culture wars out here. You know, I mean, that's all about politics. All the confusion in America is still about whose culture is going to be dominant. Or is everyone who come to America going to assimilate into a WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture? Or are they going to be forced to do that? Or are we going to create a new culture that incorporates all of Americans, which we're a very, you know, we have Native Americans, we have African Americans, we have Italians, we have, you know, people, we're a diverse group of people. So the blues was saying that we like our Louisiana culture. We don't care if you're Protestant, we're still going to do Mardi Gras. You know, we're the only state that give like almost 2 weeks of holidays to kids to go to parades and stuff for Mardi Gras. They don't do that in California or in Connecticut or Illinois. You know, I mean, we didn't want to give up our culture and the way we express our culture, even though we wanted, you know, it's like we're going to be a part of America, but I don't think anybody wants New Orleans to become Little Rock or Boston. You know, we really like our unique food, our unique culture, our unique way of doing things. And my book is about, and more in particular, about how we express ourselves musically here in South Louisiana. And like I said, when Louisianians say the word blues, it's a creolization of the word sacre bleu. And it's not, they don't mean sad and depressed and melancholy. The idea that the blues came from Mississippi, I researched that in the book as well. And so the origins of that story, we don't have time to go too far into depth about it, but I think most people have heard of Robert Johnson. And they believe somehow that Robert Johnson is the father of the blues. And somehow Louis Armstrong heard him playing the blues in Mississippi. And somehow the blues from Mississippi made its way to New Orleans and jazz was created somehow. And if you're confused by that, I'm confused by that too, because, you know, Robert Johnson wasn't even born, you know, when the blues was being played in Louisiana. The blues he was born in 1911, and the blues had been played in Louisiana. Everything I'm telling you about had been going on for about 20 years before Robert Johnson was even born. And Muddy Waters was even born later, like 1915 or something. So they weren't even, their parents hadn't even met yet. Muddy Waters' parents had not met. And Robert Johnson wasn't even born when Jelly Roll Martin and Mamie Desdunes and Buddy Bolden and all these people were playing. They were playing a music called the blues, and they called it the blues. They called it that. That wasn't a marketing term or a record company. There were no record companies. This is what they called their music, and this is how they advertised their music, and this is how they named their music. So okay, but that's what makes it the blues.
Okay, but what made it the blues then was not necessarily the sound, but the origin, like the cultural origin of it. Is that what made it the blues?
Well, if they had called it something different, then it would have been something different. This is what the in other words, when you go into a culture, if they called themselves Tejano, or they called themselves whatever, that's what they call themselves. I mean, that's their prerogative to decide what they're going to name their music. It wasn't until 20 or 30 years later that their music ended up in Chicago or New York, and where they began to market the music. And when they began to market the blues, well, the blues had a bad, a pejorative attached to it, because it was like, it had a pejorative attached to it because First of all, this was music made primarily by, you know, Black Americans. And a lot of white Americans didn't want to bring Black music into their household. So in 1921, 22, 23, 24, 25, people didn't want to, they liked the kids, the younger people liked the music. And they would go slumming in Harlem and in Chicago and go into the Black clubs and things and hear the music and go to speakeasies, which, because even drinking beer was illegal at this time. And this music was the soundtrack to like liberation for women who were for the first time going out to speakeasies, the going on dates where people would come to their homes. Usually you had to come to the house and call on the young lady and ask her out and sit and talk with the parents and all of that. But they could just meet up in a car, you know, and go on to the clubs and go do what they're going to do. So this music was kind of like the soundtrack of liberation. It was music that was saying, ain't nothing wrong with drinking beer. There's nothing wrong with drinking wine, although that was against the law. And bootlegging and all this stuff was happening. We know about bootlegging and why there were speakeasies and Al Capone and all this kind of stuff here. But these musicians was invited up to Chicago after New Orleans closed their red light district in 1917, Storyville. They were invited up to play in all the clubs of these gangsters and things. So this music, it's kind of like when people think of rock and roll, they think Bad Boys, you know? They think Keith Richards. They think, you know, Guns N' Roses. It's like these bad boys, they come in and tear up your hotel, disrupt the community and corrupt all the kids. I mean, that's kind of what rock and roll, that's a badge of honor as a rock, as Motley Crue or some rock band. They're going to come like pirates and tear up the town, you know. The blues played that role at the turn of the century in the 1920s. It was the music of rebellion, and it was the music that young people gravitated toward. But when it came to marketing the blues, you couldn't call it, okay, well, we're going to sell this blues song, or we're going to put on a blues concert at a respectable venue, because people didn't want blue music in these places. So you had to call it swing, or you called it something different. And I'll give you one more example before your next question. Elvis Presley. Elvis Presley was a blue entertainer when he came on the scene. It wasn't that he was singing sad songs. His music wasn't necessarily sad, melancholy, and all these kinds of things. His music was blue. That's why when he was on television, they filmed him from the chest up and didn't want to show him wiggling his hips and upsetting everybody watching Ed Sullivan at home, because his music wasn't the way he performed. He was a blue act. It wasn't fit for polite society. So, or at least people felt it wasn't. So the blues is more like a rebellious, you know, music that is saying that it's kind of championing and normalizing, you know, these freedoms that we're supposed to have as Americans. And so that is what I think people should focus on when they start thinking about what this music was and what it represented and what makes it America's great art form. But and for musicians, if I was in a room of musicians or a classroom of musicians, then I could get on the piano, I can get on the guitar, and I can talk more in depth about musical notes and time signatures and all that kind of stuff. But most times, I think I lose an audience if I go too far into talking like a music professor, because the message I'm really trying to get out is to just kind of do away with a lot of the myths that have been, you know, sprung up around this music. Yeah, well, it really is a cultural expression.
Let me just mention a performer, a more contemporary performer that probably everybody would be familiar with in the song that they'd be familiar with. And that would like be B.B. King and The Thrill Is Gone. Okay. That song to me is the blues. Okay. I mean, even the title, The Thrill Is Gone, everybody, okay. And then you think, so to me, that's the epitome of it. But you would say other songs, like songs that Elvis did, were also the blues. It wasn't much about the melody or anything, but just what it represented, the cultural statement.
Yeah, I think you're right. I assume that you're not debating with me about what the blues is, as more trying to get me to speak more clearly about it. Ray Charles, we talked about Ray Charles. Now, you might, if you're a fan of Ray Charles, and you might recall in the movie, the church people hated Ray Charles's music because it sounded too much like he was taking the gospel fervor of and taking gospel songs and turning them into this music for honky tonks and juke joints. Am I right about that? You recall that?
Yeah.
So they say he was singing the devil's music. That's because he was singing the blues.
Okay.
When Little Richard came to New Orleans to record his early recordings, Tutti Frutti, and these songs that he recorded in New Orleans, he came into New Orleans and recorded the blues. And these songs were, Little Richard's lyrics were so, they were so out there. You couldn't even record Tutti Frutti the way he originally was singing it in the juke joint. So they rewrote the lyrics, a wop baba loo baba la bam boom, but I'm not, even I don't want to tell you what he was saying in those lyrics that they had to change. So, you know, you lose the historical significance of the blues if you believe that it's a downtrodden music that came from slavery and work songs and field howlers and chain gangs and things like that. That is where the, and I go into depth into that in the book. And I know why we think that that's what the blues is in our popular culture. And we also think that the blues came from Mississippi and it came from slavery and things like that. But it's just not true. And I'll give you just a few quick little facts. And we can talk about them if you want me to go more in depth. The first thing people should know is that in the Atlantic slave era, the Atlantic, the millions of Africans that came out of Africa to the Americas, of all of those millions of people, only about 2 to 3% of all slaves that were brought out of Africa into the Americas came to the North America. And even less than that was in Louisiana. So if the blues had come from Africa, which I did go to Africa to do some research, I went there and studied there with people there and got this information. And I talk about that in the book as well. But if the blues had indeed come from Africa, it would have manifested in somewhere like Brazil or someplace where they had where the majority of Africans were taken, somewhere in South America or in the Caribbean. It came out of New Orleans because it's a very specific New Orleans thing. Secondly, it's a myth that Black people were enslaved in the area we call the Mississippi Delta. That's a myth because the Mississippi Delta in blues folklore is in northern Mississippi up near Arkansas and below Memphis. That's northern Mississippi. There were never any Black slaves in northern Mississippi. It never happened. There are no grave sites. There are no slave quarters. There's no grave place. There's just no evidence that there were ever any Black people enslaved in northern Mississippi where they say the blues came from. That's a myth. Not only that, when you talk about the Mississippi Delta, New Orleans is the Mississippi Delta. I mean, and Mark Twain said that's the scientific people say that's the Mississippi Delta. That's where the river spills out. I mean, that's why we're always having trouble with flooding and Katrina and all these, because we South Louisiana is the quintessential Mississippi Delta. I would call northern Mississippi, where they say the blues came from, you can call it a delta, but it's not the delta. New Orleans is the quintessential delta, even though we don't refer to it. We don't have cafes that say, yeah, New Orleans Delta coffee shop or New Orleans Delta po'boy store or whatever. You know, we don't say it, but that don't mean that scientifically we are not the Delta.
Say in the famous Peabody Hotel in Memphis, there's a plaque in the lobby that says that is the spot right there where that plaque is, where geologically the Delta begins. And then it spreads out there down into Louisiana, Mississippi. So Memphis is claiming the origin, and maybe it is. But how did Memphis get to claim the blues too? If people, the city people most associate with the blues is Memphis, and it hasn't come up once in this conversation. So,
well, yeah, because you know, I mean, St. Louis claims it. St. Louis right now has the what they call the, they spent $15 million in St. Louis to build a blues museum. They have a baseball team called the such and such a blue, whatever.
Hockey team.
Just about everybody. Yeah. And Chicago, you know, claims the blues. Mississippi claims the blues as being the birthplace. Everybody claims it except Louisiana. And that is the whole, that's my whole point, is that we originated this, but we seem to have forgotten our history. We've let we've let people in Memphis tell us who we are. We let the people in the Delta and Mississippi tell us who we are. We're letting people in New York tell us who we are. And we have to tell our own stories. And that's why this book is not ghostwritten. I did the research. I did the traveling. I spent my own money, you know, to do it, to get this book out there, because it's not enough for me to just play the guitar and sing some songs. I felt that the story, these stories, especially after my dad passed away and after the Tavish Blues Box, my family juke joint, disappeared, and especially after an event like Katrina, where I was living in New Orleans at the time, but so many people had to leave New Orleans and the culture, you got a whole new group of people moving in and gentrification and things are happening. And somebody had to tell this story, you know. And the problem that I ran up against in my research is that no African-American in America, I couldn't find one book by any African-American that had written a history of the blues. It's all been told by outsiders, by folklorists and musicologists and stuff. And they have imposed things onto people. They came up with the definition. Now, New Orleans people came up with their own definition of their music. They called it the blues. They sang the blues. It was upbeat music. It was the kind of music you get on Bourbon Street or you know, in these kind of vice districts and speakeasies. It was the music. It was the soundtrack of the, what they call the Roaring Twenties. You know, it was party music. We still do that kind of music. But when I say there was social control and culture wars happening, America did not want Jelly Roll Morton to be their quintessential a composer. They really did not want Louis Armstrong to be the great American face of American culture. America was really looking and wanted to have an Anglo face or a Nordic face to define American, this exceptional culture of America. They did not want it to be swarthy people, you know, from a place like Storyville or from Louisiana. And so they were always looking for alternatives to that. But I think that the blues did find its way. And when I say that Elvis sang the blues, I know that people use the term rock and roll. And I know people use terms like jazz and other things like that. But what we're really talking about, that's still the blues. I mean, the Rolling Stones are a blues band. Led Zeppelin is a blues band. But rock and roll, but this the rock and roll music that came about with Elvis and those people in the late 50s and 60s, once it started really making a lot of money, they kind of had a, you know, FM radio was kind of like, even though a black musician might be singing that, might have written a song and recorded the song, and they're playing the exact same notes as Little Richard or the exact same notes as B.B. King or whoever it might be. But then when a white person sings those same exact notes, the same way, the same lyrics, the same beat, everything on the music sheet is exactly the same. The only thing different is the person's skin color. But then they call the black person's music rhythm and blues or blues, and they call the white person who is singing the exact same song rock and roll. And then people come and ask me, well, isn't there a difference between blues and rock. What is the difference between Elvis singing "You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog" by Big Mama Thornton? It's just Elvis is singing it, who is more accepting, you know, even though he was still a blue entertainer and they were still a little leery of Elvis, you know. But he could get on television in the 50s and do this music. Well, if he behaved himself, but the black artists couldn't, and that's really the only difference. So rock and roll is really just a marketing term or a more acceptable name for the blues.
The term that evolved to, I guess, to separate the black music and the white music of that period, but at the same time, they'd be played on the same stations. And so it separated, but it kind of brought them together, was rhythm and blues. Right, they didn't call it the blues, they call them rhythm and blues, which is sort of like a euphemism for rock and roll.
Well, euphemism is a good word, because if you ask me, all of American popular music, even modern day country music, I can't turn, you know, we listen at a lot of country, modern country music, and we always have the radio dialed, you know, to pop country, you know, and you can't go 5 minutes listening to a country radio, popular country radio station, without them singing about boozing, getting drinking. They figure out how to whiskey and the woman and the dating and all that kind of, all those vices and things that Jelly Roll Nell was singing about 100 years ago that everybody thought was so taboo. And we got to outlaw this drinking and boozing and all this kind of stuff here. That's exactly what country music is today.
Well, the classic songs of, like, I would say the classic songs of Hank Williams. I mean, those were all just sad songs.
Yeah, but the sad. But let me. I'm glad you brought that up again, because I want to address the sad song. Can blues express sad music? Yes. And do blues express it? Yes, I do as well. I have songs that are melancholy and heartache type of tunes. They'll bring a tear to your eyes, some of them. I mean, but black people didn't invent sad songs. We didn't invent that. They've had sad songs going back to biblical age. You know, a sad song been sung for thousands of years. So that's not the definition. That is the definition we have been taught, and that's why my book is important. Because it's dismantling these kinds of myths. You know, people say, well, these people, blues come from slavery, which it didn't. And they say, well, slavery, you know, they got to be miserable. So they're singing a miserable song, so that's the blues. And that's incorrect. The work song, when you think about the work song, you think about John Lomax recording Leadbelly, coming to Louisiana, coming to Baton Rouge, going to Angola prison to record Leadbelly. And not just Leadbelly, but any prisoners that they could find that could sing him a tune, and they would take it back to the Library of Congress and hold it up as being authentically, you know, black expression. Now, this is the authentic, the real, unadulterated, you know, black folk music. But why are they in the prison? And why are they recording people on chain gangs? And why are they, what's that all about? I don't have anything against them recording the musicians in the chain gang and the musician in the prison. But the reason they're doing that is because it's kind of, they're on a eugenic type of mission. They're not really trying to record the music. They think that that's the natural state of black people in chains, in slavery, in captivity. And then you want them to sing almost with the chains on their arms and legs. Well, and so the history of work songs, where you see a chain gang, everybody singing in rhythm and moving the railroad track or nailing down on the railroad track, that's not an invention of black people. That's a mechanism of work and enslavement. But that goes back to the pirates. That goes back 1,000 years. People rowing these boats, and everybody singing in unison. They're called sea shanties. You know, they're work songs. Work songs weren't invented by black people, and that's not the origins of the blues. Nobody say that Mick Jagger Rod Stewart, you know, got their songs from work songs from Plowmen or sea shanties. You know what I mean? No, we don't talk about other kinds of music the way we talk have been talking about the blues. So the blues needed to be talked about as what it is. It's a musical, it's a cultural expression, and it's an art form, and it should be talked in that with that type of language, as opposed to being talked about as being a primitive people, a primitive expression of a primitive people, which is the way it has been misrepresented. And that's really this whole primitive myth is what this book, my book, The Blues, The Authentic Narrative of My Music and Culture, it debunks.
Yeah, well, one of the mentions, the your comments make me think about the mystique of prison. Leadbelly, who may have been the biggest star to come out of Louisiana, except for the time when he didn't get much attention, but he did go to prison. Johnny Cash never went to prison, but he made people think that he did. I mean, you know, he dressed in black, he performed at Folsom Prison with and all that.
He married a black woman.
Was she? I know she was Mexican. Was she Mexican in part black? Or?
I think she was a black woman.
Okay. Well, I've seen pictures of it. It could very well be. But it's just the idea of Johnny Cash tried to sell that notion. And it was, I guess, in that crowd it worked, I guess. Anyway. Okay, this is fascinating stuff, man. It really is. Look, you're onto something. And I know, like in history, that sometimes people find the truth and it's hard to get it across, okay? Because there are so many things that are out there, all that. I see this in my own life with some research I've done on Mardi Gras. You know, that there are things out there that are wrong, and you try to tell them, no, this is right, man. And it's just what you got to think. You just got to keep on going, you know? You got to keep on going, prime with the message. Just one thing that comes to mind, and I know we need to move on. When we're talking about the blues, and we're talking about the ones in New Orleans, the like Basin Street Blues and Bourbon Street Blues and Rampart Blues, and which have a kind of an upbeat sound, but there's one that Louis Armstrong did called West End Blues, which is a beautiful, beautiful song, but it's very, very, and it's not as popular as the rest of them, but it's very, very sad. It is a very melancholy song, and it kind of ends with his sort of like humming along. And so these almost seem like two different genres of music, but I think it fits in the same way with the other ones. Oh no, I'm just moved by that piece. I think it's an important piece of music.
Yeah, West End Blues that you speak of, I do write about that. West End Blues was written by King Oliver, and King Oliver is from the Metro Baton Rouge, and He moved down to New Orleans and became very popular in a band called the Creole Band. And that band was you know, he had Kid Ory in the band. That was the hottest band in Louisiana after Buddy Bolden passed away. Buddy Bolden was institutionalized at the Jackson Insane Asylum. That's where he ended up around 1907. But King Oliver wrote West End Blues. King Oliver became Louis Armstrong's mentor and taught him the blues and helped develop him as a musician and got him one of his first trumpets. And when King Oliver left Louisiana, left New Orleans around 1917, 1919 or whatever, at the end of Storyville to move to Chicago to work for the gangsters and the speakeasies and stuff. He later invited Louis Armstrong to come to Chicago to join him. And so Louis Armstrong was his understudy, played second trumpet under King Oliver, great blues band. And they won, and the original Dixieland Jazz Band was the first band to record the New Orleans blues. They had a hit in 1917 with a song called Lively Stable Blues. They were the first ones to have a popular hit with it, let me put it like that, from New Orleans. But one of the first blues bands to record was King Oliver, with Louis Armstrong on second trumpet, the Creole band. And they recorded songs like China Blues and other songs like this. And then Louis Armstrong, a couple of years later, redid Western Blues, I think around 1925. And that is the introduction of his horn on that song is amazing. And that's when the solo instrument, I mean, you know, being able to express yourself within a song arrangement, kind of go beyond the page and just improvise, you know, over a piece of music. You know, people hadn't really heard that on record before, at least not in the way that Louis Armstrong was able to do it. And that started a whole, you know, movement about improvisation and that type of thing. But Western Blues, if you look at it, it's a 12-bar blues tune. It's called Western Blues. That's what King Oliver named the song. And it's about the West End of New Orleans, where they had Lake Pontchartrain and stuff, you know. So, I mean, the thing is, but then people want to call that jazz, or they want to call it something else. But it's the blues.
It's something.
And it is a great recording.
Yeah, to me, it's the blues. And if you haven't heard it, man, you people out there, just look it up. You know, go to on the internet and find it. It's beautiful, and you'll be shocked at what it is. It kind of starts off with a little riff that Louis Armstrong does it, then gets into it. But and to me, that's the blues. There's no doubt about it. Just one other thing I want to mention. I know we need to go, but the pattern you talked about with the blues, like starting in New Orleans and then going to Chicago and then going to Harlem, New York, that was the same thing with jazz, that this kind of music originated in New Orleans, went upriver, didn't have a name until it got to Chicago, and Chicago got the name jazz, and then ultimately went to New York and it was packaged and recorded. Oh, yeah. And I said, once something is recorded, that kind of puts the music a little bit more of a straitjacket. I mean, it regulates the sound and the speed and the length of it and all that. And so that becomes the next step. But with that same kind of pattern, you know, New Orleans to Chicago to New York.
Here's the thing. The word jazz is a misnomer. There's no such thing as jazz. That's just like I said, when the blues became a pejorative, they began to call it other names. Jazz is one of those names. Now, we're running out of time, so I could go on the whole history of that word and the etymology of it and how it came to be called jazz. Or really, it was called Dixieland jazz, and then they dropped the word Dixieland and just started calling it jazz. But Miles Davis rejected the word jazz. Louis Armstrong never called himself a jazz musician. None of these people, that's the name they had to work under. That was their checks, you know, for the festivals was printed, it said, from the jazz festival, and so they cashed the check. But they never embraced the term jazz. You know, I've never met a jazz musician that embraced that term, not any of the greats. They're blues musicians, but they can't call themselves blues and play a card. They weren't able to call themselves blues musicians and get on television. They weren't able to call themselves blues musicians and play at Carnegie Hall. They weren't able to call themselves blues musicians and get played on FM radio. They said, we don't play blues here. We only play rock and roll. So the blues have always been kind of pushed back because it came on the scene as such a powerful force that threatened social order and Jim Crow and the social order of America. It really challenged it because it brought white kids and black kids together. And, you know, and that was against the law. It was actually against the law for white people and black people to be in the same room together, let alone dancing together. Louis Armstrong said he was never going to come back to Louisiana after he came to Louisiana and he had a white musician in his band. And they said, he can't play here. Y'all can't play as an integrated group. And he said he would never come back to Louisiana and he didn't even want to be buried here. So we forget now of how things were 100 years ago when this music came along. But this was a very powerful music that helped to kind of give America a cultural identity. It's an art form that have been adopted all over the world. Whether you call it K-pop or whether you call it hip-hop or bebop or rock and roll or anything else you want to call it, it's all based on the blues that came out of Louisiana originally, because before the music came out of Louisiana, it didn't exist. That type of music philosophy, that type of culture expression didn't exist anywhere else in the world that I could find, or that any other writer have been able to find, a researcher. So I think Louisiana, we should be proud of it, and we shouldn't be ashamed to embrace, once we know the real, now who wants to embrace in music of enslavement, music of chain gangs and criminals and prisoners? That's really a false history. But we all would love to, I think, embrace the real origin story and the real meaning of this music, which is quintessential freedom of expression. You know, so, you know, and I know we have to wrap up here, but I would just say that all those names like jazz, there's no such thing as jazz music. Like I said, if you play the exact same notes, the exact same songs, but they want to call it pop or call it rock, and then when the black musicians do the exact same notes, all of a sudden it's a different form of music. So we're not really talking about music at this point. We're talking about society and social, what's acceptable socially and that type of thing. And so I think that I think black musicians, white musicians, black dancers, white dancers, black festival goers, white festival goers, and everybody else can rally around and enjoy a style of music. But then when it comes to the marketplace, as far as who gets paid, who owns, who copyrights, who, all these kind of things here, that's when all the confusion and all the, they got to find new names and new ways to kind of sell things, the marketplace. But our culture in Louisiana, whether the record business dies and whether there is no more streaming of music, or whether there is no more Billboard charts, I would like to see 200 years from now that people in Louisiana still dancing at Congo Square on Sundays, still doing their second line, still expressing their music their way, and our culture, you know, can kind of continue and be its unique and beautiful self. I don't really want to see that it's lasted for a couple of hundred years. They were expressing the blues before the record business was invented, before music even came on record. And now that the record business is over, basically, we still are expressing the music in New Orleans and in South Louisiana in ways that they don't do at other places. So we can't define our culture by some record executive in Manhattan or Hollywood. You know, they might make movies about New Orleans and TV shows about New Orleans and stuff like that, but we have to remember who we are and kind of continue to do what we're doing, because we're doing something right. The whole world is singing our tune.
But on the racial thing, you know, from the beginning, there was always a bit of a tug of war between on jazz, between blacks and whites, particularly blacks and Italian musicians, who I think pretty much got along together. But ultimately, to me, when people think of jazz, they think of it as black musicians. That the most popular names, the biggest names in jazz, are all the black musicians.
Because jazz is basically the blues. There's no such thing. I don't know any jazz musicians. I know people that call themselves jazz musicians, but they're not jazz musicians. I mean, if they're a great musician, if it's a great jazz musician and somebody like a Miles Davis or a Duke Ellington or a Count Basie or whoever, you know, if you get them off camera and get them off the record, they're going to talk to you about the blues. The only places they talk about jazz is in academia, you know, like a conservatory. But kids, why would you go and spend $80,000 a year to go to a music conservatory and learn all of that foolishness, when really you just need to be 5 or 6 years old and somebody put an accordion in your hand, or put a fiddle in your hand, or put a trumpet or a drum in your hand and put you in the parade that's your musical education right there. You just continue your culture and find your way to express it there. But this conservatory, that's a whole another conversation that we could have. And this is not a, I'm not a, you know, this is not a poll maker against jazz musicians. I mean, Dr. Michael White, the great jazz musician, clarinetist and professor in New Orleans, is, if you read the back of my book, he, you know, highly endorses it.
Oh yeah, he speaks very
highly.
Which is
yeah. So I mean, yeah. So as far as jazz goes, and I'm not saying that, you know, the New Orleans Jazz Festival has to change its name, but what I do want is for the narrative, how we talk about this music, to be different. Because right now, when you go to blues festivals and you go to these different places, you mentioned jazz, there are not really any Black people in the audience, and there are not many Black people on the stage. Now, you're talking about your record collection. In your record collection, you probably have a lot of Black jazz musicians, but a lot of them are long gone. But and even in blues, I mean, there are young people aren't playing the blues. They're doing other kinds of things. But I guess without going on and on in detail and stuff like this, I think that the narrative that have been sold about the blues is one that the Black community has really rejected. And that's why you don't see a lot of young Black musicians picking up the music. But then a lot of the societies, blues societies and benevolent societies that said that they're here to preserve the blues, and they say that the blues is dying. Usually what they're saying is that that rural kind of plantation type of person or that kind of primitive person is dying out. And so that's how they decide who's authentic or not in ways, which is absurd. You should be able to have a master's degree from a university and be a blues musician. You don't have to just be, you know, well, on your resume, you know, or have you ever picked cotton or, you know, have you done some time in prison or something? I mean, that's not the criteria. At least it shouldn't be.
Okay. Well, this is good.
Can we do this again someday? Maybe, Father, there's so many things we didn't talk about, you know. I'd like to elaborate, if you don't mind. Let's do a follow-up one day. That's okay.
Yeah, we could do a follow-up, but I would encourage you to, some of the things that I'm saying, the definitions and things that I'm giving, it's like we're speaking a different language sometimes, and I have to do a lot of definitions that takes up a lot of the time, which I don't mind, because I think the you know, the person listening might not have read the book or whatever, so it's good to go into depth. But I think some of the things I've written about, if a person have read some of my book and read some of those definitions, I could go even more into depth. You know, we could have even a more profound conversation. If a person just understands that the word blue or blue entertainment is French, you know, and that comes out of Louisiana, where it was misinterpreted to mean melancholy and sad and down in the dumps when it went to Chicago 20 some years later. That would be very helpful if people just understood those two distinctions. Then we could really have a good, even more in-depth conversation next time.
Well, the historian is going to always be ahead of the class in terms of the technicality. Okay. Anyway, but a good head start would be, though, for people to read the book. And again, it's called The Blues, The Authentic Narrative of My Music and Culture, published by the Chicago Review Press. And I assume it's
available everywhere where books are sold, right? And on the websites and all that. So it should be easy to get.
Yeah. Yeah, it should be in all the bookstores. It's available at Amazon and wherever books are sold. And it's on audiobook. It's on, you know, Kindle, you know, electronic book and everything like that as well. And it was nominated as One Book, One Community here. And so we're celebrating that next week, which I'm very, you know, pleased to have been, that the book was nominated and chosen for that award. So The word is getting out there. You know, hopefully one day in the future, Louisiana will re-embrace this music. It's Louisiana's gift to the world, really.
What's your most current recording out there if somebody wanted to buy it?
Most of my music you can find, well, really all of my published music almost is at iTunes, Spotify, anywhere that you listen to digital music. If you just type in Chris Thomas King on your streaming service, my whole catalog of music will come up. I've recorded about 200 songs or so, maybe 15 or 16 albums, I lose count. I'm working on a new album as we speak, and hopefully it'll be out this summer. What else I can tell people? Because I talk about everything else except my own music. What else I can say? I've sold over 10 million records, you know, have gold and platinum records that I've written and also recorded. The Ray score was very popular. Old Brother Where Art Thou movie and the Ray movies as an actor were Oscar-nominated movies that I've been a part of. And so, and I played, headlined or co-headlined, you know, places like Carnegie Hall, Radio City, all our great theaters, the Ryman in Nashville. So I've had quite a journey as a composer, as a musician, and now I'm as an author. You know, I'm doing some things and starting to think about what my next book might be. So the journey continues. You know.
And you were also in the HBO series Tremé. That was in 2011. So,
There's several TV shows, and there's other movies I've been a part of. You know, dozens of movies and documentaries and things as an actor and film score and stuff like that. But like you said, you know, but most people, my biggest Hollywood films were those two. I also did a Broadway play a couple of years back, which we had to stop because of COVID when everything shut down. So I'm continuing to, you know, express my talent or my poetry or whatever in any form and any way that I can. The only thing I haven't done is picked up a paintbrush.
Okay.
And so don't expect me to pick up a paintbrush, but, you know, I appreciate all the arts and I try to dabble in all of them.
Yeah. When you retire, you can do that. What was the name of the Broadway play?
Lackawanna Blues.
Okay. So is there a possibility that you bring it back or?
It had its run. We were in Los Angeles for about 3 months, and we were scheduled to go to Boston and to New Jersey and then to Broadway. And then COVID canceled those things. But I have the production might end up in those places again, but I have kind of moved on since then. So I probably won't be rejoining the play.
Yeah, you're one of those plays. I mean, you got to be there every night, you know? I mean, you can't go places, you can't be around, you know? So
you got so
you
much.
Know it. You know it.
You got so much
it's
else.
It's a whole different kind.
Yeah, it's a whole different
kind. And you got to do the exact same thing. You don't do a whole lot of improvising in a play, you know what I mean? You got to stick to the script. So.
Yeah, you don't want that, okay. All right, Chris Thomas King, thank you. It's been,
and you also performed at the Jazz Fest.
I performed with my band at the Jazz Fest Friday, May 5th. And I'm so fortunate that they, you know, invited me this year. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that as well. And to keep up with anything that I'm doing, it's at ChrisThomasKing.com. I have, since I did the book, I have established a nonprofit called the Blues Origin Institute. And so the Blues Origin Institute is a place that people can donate and people can get involved and try to continue to build on this idea of the blues origins being right here in Louisiana.
Thank you very much. And thanks to Kelly for
Thank you.
Helping us work through some technical problems. It was delightful. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.